So it's mostly about words and concepts, and they and the general issue is the general context is thinking about what novel things the evolutionary transitions research program can make us think about, like adaptations, organisms, and individuals. And essentially, the question here is how does evolutionary transition research impact on our conception of adaptation? So I'll first very, very roughly sketch what organisms, adaptation, and individuality as a concept are, and some issues they raise in the classical modern synthesis Darwinian framework. And then I'll go to what the evolutionary transition programs has new to propose about individuals, and how it newly asks the question, and then I'll turn to adaptation, and I'll focus on one issue raised about adaptation by the evolutionary transitions question, and I'll turn to the consequences about individuality. So, as to adaptation, Darwin's idea is to explain the fit between organisms and their environment via natural selection. So that's a very, very general framework. And as you know, so for example, this is the famous Darwin finches. So he explains the beak of the finches, and he explained why the various species of finches have those beaks, which seem very well fit to their environments, by natural selection, which cumulatively force each species, specializes each species in a way that it can reach its specific prey in the niche of the prey within the various trees. So it's the natural selection is the way environment. Well, thank you. So this one and this one. Well, that's sorry for the horrible drawings, but anyway, so the beak is made sort of designed by natural selection to find out to attain the insect in the tree. And so that's the general idea, being that natural selection explain adaptation of organisms. And but in Darwin we have this interesting thing that adaptations are in the first place about traits. So that's the chapter 6 of The Origin of the Species, where he's sort of summarizing the very general consequences of his theory about function, form, unity of type. And he says natural selection is by either now adapting the varying parts of each being to its organic conditions. And then he says the adaptations, and here the adaptations mean the traits, being aided in some cases by use and disuse. So I want to focus on, I want to emphasize this move from the organisms are adapted to their environments to traits are adaptation. And this trend is reinforced by the modern synthesis, since traits are traced back to genes, and so you have this focus on genes as adapted. And so organisms in this, for Darwin and for traditionally, they are those entities with design, and Darwin said in the orchid books that they have exquisite contrivances, so all parts seem contrived to a common purpose, which is survival and reproduction of the organism. And so they display functional integrity, and they are organized, and the organization being entailed by the fact that parts are contrived. And in the Darwinian framework, then there is a tension between the fact that traits are the adaptations and organisms are adapted. So there are questions how you go from understanding adaptations to understanding the adaptedness of organisms. And for some people in the modern synthesis, the solution is that the organisms are bundles of adaptation. And that's something which was not shared by all the biologists in the modern synthesis, but anyway, it was part of the synthesis. And so it's the idea that organisms, in a way, can be understood as a trade-off between adaptation for a distinct environmental demand. So once you have understood the traits as adaptation, basically you have understood organisms. And that was the target of many of the people who are challenging the modern synthesis. First of all, the Gould and Lewontin paper in 79, which was attacking adaptationism. So their idea of bioplan is the idea that you cannot think organisms just as a bundle of adaptation. You have to think of what they call bioplan, which is slightly mysterious, as a set of constraints which is imposed onto adaptations. And for this reason, some people said that the modern synthesis was the times of an eclipse of organism, especially because population genetics is understood as the science of the process of evolution by natural selection. And in population genetics, organisms are not at the at the foreground. I mean, they are sort of eclipsed. And they, so the, turning to individuals, in general, individual is something more general than organisms. It's like things which disappear when you divide them. A table is an individual, but half a table is not an individual. And they are soft of cohesive. So that's the very intuitive view of, idea of individuals. And for a long time, metazoan organisms are the paradigm of individuality. If you read like Aristotle, Leibniz, the example of individuals are always like cats, human, trees, even though they are talking of individuals in general. And in biological talk, often individuals mean organisms. And on the other hand, individuals are often identified by analogy with organisms. So, for example, people were saying that beehives were sort of individuals because they were like organisms. And in the 18th century, people were thinking the other way around, that an organism is sort of like a beehive because each part is like a bee, which lives its life, but for the good of the whole. But the problem is that some biological individuals, I mean, biology is rich of individuals which are very, very much not like organisms. So like Portuguese men of war, slime molds, dandelions, so, and essentially they lack spatial cohesion and they lack temporal cohesion. One philosopher, which was David Hull, said that basically evolutionary theory provides us a theory not of not of organisms, but of individuality. So he says, in the theory, we know what we can individuate things. To be an individual is to be a unit of selection. So organism is something. Organisms are a kind of individuals. But what the theory provides us with is a criterion for individuals. And since you have various levels of selection, you'll have many individuals. And now the evolutionary transition program. It's a new take, started by Mena Smith and Chad Murray and the book by Rick Mitchell. I mean, many of you here are doing this. The very general way to approach it is to say that it switches the question. It goes from what are individuals to the question, how did the kinds of individuals we know come to exist? And so whereas the classical framework assumes the units of selection, so it assumes that there are genes, there are cells, there are organisms. Here, we think that they are themselves resulting from evolution by natural selection, and then we want to know how. And the point is that this switch impacts our conception of selection. I mean, if we do not think genes and populations of genes and organisms as a given, it's more difficult to have a very general view of selection, like Lewontin's, for example, with the three criteria. And it impacts many things. For example, it impacts the way we think of inheritance, the way we would think of information. And so, for example, for many aspects and Chatmari, the new individual kinds of individuals are also new kinds of storing information. And it would impact our understanding of adaptation. So that's what I'm talking about now. And about organisms, what's interesting here is that against the view that there is an eclipse of organisms in the classical modern synthesis framework, again, the view that, like Gould and Lewin, Gould saying that the modern synthesis can't account for organisms, here we have a way to understand the fact of multicellular organisms, to answer the question of why do most things come under the form of an organisms rather than differently. And in this program, there are two general ideas, very, very general ideas. The first is that what now are individuals were once groups of individuals living on their own. And so the question is how selection did lead these free living individuals to come to live together, or how could it lead them to live together? So that's two different kind of questions, one asking how possibly something can occur, and one asking how actually something did occur, and you find those two brands of questions in people working on evolutionary transition. And it implies that multi-level selection is a privileged scheme for explaining this. And the second general idea is that there is threshold of individuality that is reached when groups can reproduce as a whole, and citing Maynard Smith and Sadmari, entities that were capable of independent replication before the transition can only replicate as parts of a larger unit after it. And being very general, how can the evolution of individuality occur? I think that many models present a two-stage process. The first one, there is a first stage where you model the conditions under which evolution by natural selection works in a way that favors trade-offs between fitness of entities, so that things that are clusters of entities that are together can emerge. So you can call it social clusters, and I think that's something which Corinna was talking about when she was thinking of how things are either staying together or tend to come together. There's two ways of forming social clusters. And there is a second stage which models the way those social clusters evolve the means to be maintained through time as coherent rules. And they get buffered against the fact that living by oneself has always a higher payoff in fitness. So there is a higher payoff to defection. So you have two stages, and the first seems more like an origin question, the second seems more like a maintenance question about high-level individuals. And in the second stage, you have specific adaptations which allow the buffering against the dismantling of the individual. And so I'm citing Rick Mitchell here. So the first stage is exemplified by this sentence, like, during the emergence of a new unit, there are several ways to facilitate the train toward a higher level of organization, and population structure here is very important, as well as relatedness. And the second stage is the train toward a higher level of organization, culminating in an adaptation that legitimizes the new unit once and for all. And examples are a cell membrane, a germline of self-polishing functions, and etc. So the question here is, what does it mean to talk of this adaptation? So that's my question. What does it mean to say that it legitimizes once and for all an individuals? And so the question, and well, just here I call them I adaptations, these adaptations that are like that are legitimizing a new individuals, and they create the new individual in a way because they make it unlikely to regress to the form of a group. So the problem here is that originally adaptations are traits which are carried by individuals, and here we have a trait which is logically prior to the individual because it sort of creates the individual. So there's a sort of logical question here, which is what is the bearer of such adaptation? And if to make the problem more precise, if you turn to the conceptions of adaptation, there are two families of philosophical conception of adaptation, I think. The first one is historical, and actually it is very widely shared by philosophers of biology. And it says that to be an adaptation is to have come to existence and to remain there via natural selection. So it's supposed to capture the Darwinian understanding of adaptation as essentially tied to natural selection. And the result is that to say that something is an adaptation is a historical statement, is to say something about its history. It's not a description. But the problem is that in many cases we know that something is an adaptation, but we don't know its history. We say it without regarding its history. So that's why some behavioral ecologists put forth another view, which is a currentist view, and it says that to be an adaptation is to be the highest fitness phenotypic variant. So it's supposed to capture the way behavioral ecologists identify adaptation. And well, it's not real. They may not be really competing views of adaptation. And someone could say, as actually Reuven Scherman say, and as Brandon is now tending to say, that the historical view of adaptation corresponds to a question about the origin of something, whereas a maintenance question asking why some strategy or why some trait or behavior still here. Is in this sense, in this explanatory program, explaining maintenance of a trait or a behavior, we use a currentist view of adaptation because we don't look at the history. And the problem here is that none of those views fit the case of what I call the I adaptation. So those adaptations which sort of create a new kind of individual. So because, well, the first thing is we would tend to say that saying that something is an I adaptation answers the maintenance question. Why is it that, for example, the cell, when it happens, is maintained into existence rather than being dismantled by the selection for independent genes living independently? But the problem is that, is it a trait of the basic individual, so the for example, the free-living chromosomes? The problem is that the free-living individuals, the ones which have the highest fitness, are not the ones which have the high adaptation, because it's the one which has the lowest fitness which will come into the group. And for example, there is a paper by Hochberg, Herbert, and the colleagues that it is showing that the cheaters, which are in some models of evolutionary transitions, the cheaters which have the highest fitness disperse, so they don't share the eye adaptation precisely. And if you want to say that this eye adaptation is of the high level individuals, the problem is that you may not have variance here, so you cannot compare them to lower level fitness variants. You might have only one of these cell and then free living chromosomes. So there's a problem here, and it can't be an adaptation in the historical sense neither, because, for example, if you think of the membrane, you didn't have a selective process where cell with membrane and cells without membranes did compete. It doesn't make any sense. So you cannot say that the membrane is an adaptation in the sense that it results from natural selection. So there is a problem here, and I think to solve the puzzle we have to turn to inclusive fitness. So inclusive fitness being the sum of like direct fitness benefits and indirect fitness benefits modulated by relatedness. If you also think that relatedness taking most generally is mostly a statistical association on the focal locus rather than a genome-wide association, so it can be either produced by kinship or it can be produced by other mean, and so here I refer to what Weston, Griffin, and Gardner called broad kin selection. So it would include Greenbeard mechanisms that promote altruistic traits but don't rely on kinships. And so with this very general view of inclusive fitness, you could show that it plays a role in many evolutionary transitions. So here, instance of green beards have been found playing a role in the transition of slime molds to multicellular life. So, and because there is a general equivalence between kin selection and multilevel selection, so that many things that you say about evolution transition in terms of multilevel selection can be translated into inclusive fitness terms, you can have a very general framework to address this problem of adaptation in evolutionary transitions. And so if you put things in those terms, the answer to what is this kind of adaptation is sort of simple. It's just that it's the highest inclusive fitness variant trait. And so that would work if you think of apoptosis in cells, which is one of those important eye adaptation. So the cell which does apoptosis has a lowest fitness, but it like direct fitness, personal fitness, but it has a higher inclusive fitness than other cells. And in this way, if apoptosis evolved and characterized new individuals, you can say that it is an adaptation because it is the highest inclusive fitness variance. So in general, I think the way to think of those adaptations we create individuals can be to see them in terms of trait providing highest inclusive fitness to basic individuals, to individuals at the low levels. And once you say this, you can you can also say that they are adaptation in a historical sense, because I mean they are resulting of process of a kin selection process. But the important thing here is I think that the differences between saying that those adaptations are adaptation in the current sense or in the historical sense can relate to the fact that rely ultimately to the fact that you don't address the process at the same time scale. So either you address it on a short time scale, and so that's the maintenance issue, and then the eye adaptation will be seen as according to the currentist view of adaptation, or you see it on a longer time scale and it will be seen as according to the historical view of adaptation. So the consequences about individuals are the following. Because kinship is not the only cause for higher latentness, it might be that this model of transition can be extended to egalitarian transitions, as David Collard called them. So transitions where you don't have kinship between all the individuals that are involved in the transition. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is that here I'm using a paper by Foster and colleagues about complete and component tragedies of the commons. So they distinguish cases where the tragedy of the common is complete and they where a group finally disappear, and cases where they are component, and so the tragedy is sort of partially overcome by some mechanism. And what I'm aiming here is that too is that if we consider the distinction between egalitarian and fraternal transition on the one hand, and on the other hand the distinction between you define a distinction between component and complete transitions, which means that you think of some transitions as complete, so they do the two stages, a stage where you have social clustering and a stage where they reach some high adaptations. And some of transitions are just component transitions, so they just are stuck at the social clustering stage, but they don't go to the stage where you'll find a specific eye adaptation which legitimize a new kind of individuality. And then you'll have four kinds of transitions, so like fraternal, complete, fraternal, component, egalitarian, complete, and egalitarian, and component. I think so the transition toward multicellular organisms is often fraternal and complete, and many cases of of sociality among insects or bacteria are component transitions. So you have social clustering that might be egalitarian or fraternal, but you don't find a specific adaptation. So for example, in Bacillus subtilis, you have social clustering. So when food is scarce, they come together and they so that they can survive by maximizing the amount of food they reach. But then they will not go to a kind of eye adaptation which will ensure that this compound of bacteria will be reproduced as one piece. So when you have more food, they just separate. So that's typically a component transition, and it's fraternal because they are kins. So to conclude, With this scheme, you can understand degrees of individuality according to the character of transitions. So you don't have you don't have a criterion for individuality, like in the Hull's view. Unit of selection is an individual, but you have degrees of individuality according to they are resulting from one of those four kinds of transitions. But the point is that since it's not a scale, but you have two dimensions, individualities cannot be totally ordered. You cannot say for two given kind of individuals that one is more an individual than another. Sometimes it's not comparable. You can just say that according to at which point to whether you are a component or complete transitions and to the amount and the of I adaptations and their relations that some individuals are more individual than others, but it's not totally ordered. And so you can just say that there are many transient individuals, which basically repeats some what Quell and Strassmann were saying here, the fact that you can see transitions at a sort of finer grained than major transitions, and then you'll have a sort of way of defining transient individuals. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, Philippe. So do we have any questions, Mike?
Eye adaptations, are they adaptations to prevent you from collapsing, or are they adaptations that have a consequence that you don't collapse?
They have the consequence that you don't collapse.
But they're not necessarily adaptations to prevent that collapse. So are they adaptations? So you could imagine that you can have adaptations to prevent cheating and defection. So policing would be an adaptation, right?
Yeah.
But you're not talking about policing, or you are including policing in this.
No, I'm talking about those adaptations that, I mean, like the membrane, which are actually making the collapsing so unlikely that you have
So it's a consequence then.
Yeah, so it's a consequence.
Okay,
yeah,
all right.
It's a consequence.
Thanks.
Yeah. Dustin, oh yeah. I guess I have a similar question, just the difference between an eye adaptation and what some people have called conflict mediators, like policing or germline.
Yeah.
Are they the same thing?
Yeah, I think in some cases some conflicts mediations to the extent that they make the collapsing unlikely would be a kind of adaptation. And if you think of something which makes the conflict very unlikely, like bottleneck, if you think this in terms of like conflict policing, because it makes like mutations very much unlikely, you could say it would be an adaptation. But if you think of like repressing mechanisms, like social mechanism for repressing cheating, this would not be legitimizing a new kind of individuals. I think that's according to the kind of conflict mediation process and how it is involved in a transition, the answer will be different, I think. So,
I just had another follow-up question. I'd always seen one of the advantages of a multi-level selection framework is that you don't have to take the position of what level something is an adaptation for. You can kind of watch the population evolve. And I was wondering if you would agree with that. Or not?
Yeah. I think even though you don't have to decide that at some point you have to say that you have a novel kind of individual likely to carry adaptations at some point. And the question is how to characterize the fact that this switch between the low level individuals that are grouped and when they can like reproduce as a whole, for example. And they it's not that I want to get rid of the fact that you can watch the adaptation. You can watch the selective process and don't ask at what level something belong. But it's just the fact that if you want to be able to say that here you have individuals and here you have like parts of individuals, and to make a difference, you have to be able to characterize those sets of adaptations that are proper to the thing which you will say it is an individual. It was just to emphasize that if you want this, then you have to the usual views of adaptations are not likely to capture this kind of adaptations easily. That was just the point. It's not just to contest the multi-level framework. It's just to find a way to account for those specific adaptations that at some point you want to name as like adaptations.
I'm a bit confused about the fact that you seem to base your I adaptations on some lower level properties. To me, it is not obvious that whenever you have ensembles of lower level properties, then you can identify these ensembles as higher level individuals or, let's say, something that participates to evolution at a higher level. When you had your definition based on inclusive fitness, I think there is something missing somehow of how you go to this higher level and how does this higher level really participate as a Darwinian individual into the evolutionary dynamics instead of being just the consequence of the emergence of some lower level properties that could evolve in time.
You mean that it seems to deprive the high-level individuals of any kind of like causal property or causal role in evolution? Is it the question or?
Maybe it's more that if you have an ensemble of lower-level units, you have an origin problem just in telling how do the things replicate or they reproduce. you might argue more about this, but it's just that it does not come from free from, I think, the lower level properties. So I don't really understand how you speak about evolutionary properties of collectives when you have not defined what a collective, how can a collective reproduce or be a Darwinian organism?
Okay. I think that was, well, I wanted to separate the question, but I think that the collective can reproduce and be a Darwinian entity precisely when it has some adaptations that make it something different than just a collection, like a pack of wolves is not it's behaving as a whole but not reproducing as a whole, and because it lacks those adaptations that, for example, multicellular organisms have that make them so unlikely to be dismantled into separate cells that they can reproduce as a whole, even if that's not the only reason that they reproduce as a whole. It's just a condition.
But what comes first then, the higher level adaptation or individuality at the higher level? It seems to me there's a chicken and egg problem that, and there's a hole that you end up going down into, unless you consider the possibility that the very earliest traits that emerge are ones that allow the nascent group to participate to some extent in evolutionary properties, in evolutionary processes at the higher level. And then traits adaptive at that higher level are a natural consequence of the entities being Darwinian individuals. Otherwise, you end up, I think, arguing that traits adaptive at the higher level have emerged prior to the emergence of any semblance of individuality at the higher level.
Yeah, I think that was sounding like a chicken and egg problem. I think that was the that was what I was trying to emphasize, that they just using the usual accounts of like adaptations and individuals was running into a sort of chicken and egg problem. That was the point I was trying to make. So I would tend to agree. And then if you consider the adaptations, if you consider those adaptations, you have to refine the meaning of you have to refine the meaning of adaptations to take those adaptations into account to avoid the chicken and egg problem. But I don't know. I assume it's not a satisfactory answer, but I just wanted to stress the fact that there might be something problematic here, conceptually speaking, even though it's not really relevant for modeling the process.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay, I think we have time for one more question. You have.
I think it's not necessarily a chicken egg problem, because you can imagine taking a multicellular organism with symbionts in it, okay, and you can so typically it would the unit of selection here would be the whole, right? But you can disassemble it. For example, you can take away the symbionts. In many organisms, the organism will be viable. And so it would exist also as an individual, and also the symbionts you can find conditions in which the symbionts would exist separately. So and still you can get a whole that will become unit of selection. But I think this shows that in many and perhaps most and maybe even all cases, the units, the individuals were the original units, and then they come together to form a new unit, with or without losing their ability to be individual units.
Yeah, but I mean, from the viewpoint, for example, of if you want to find criteria for individuality, from the viewpoint of this whole project, it makes a difference that they are reproducing or are without reproduction. So if you want to ask a question about what do we mean by individuals and what kinds of individuals there are and so on, you can't just say that you have free living individuals and they might be into collective or not. I mean, you can always consider them in a collective and apart, and consider that they are separate, and that under some conditions they are together, and under some conditions they are by themselves. But if you want to give criteria about when things are more or less individuals, and for example, why ant colonies are more individuals than pack of lions huntings, for example, you cannot say that in those two cases individuals enter in the collective in exactly in the same way. I mean, it makes a difference that in some case they are invested in reproduction of other individuals very differently than in some other cases. So.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Philippe. Yeah. I think we should stop there. So just to let you know that lunch is out here in the courtyard, and I think we're meeting back in an hour and a half or 2 o'clock.
Yeah. 2 o'clock.